These days, it's a bit of a dilemma to know where to plant your savings. The interest rates on savings accounts is very close to zero and definitely does not keep up with inflation. The stock market, always a risk. NPR's Uri Berliner has been using some of his savings to explore different investments. In this segment of our series, Dollar for Dollar, we find him stocking up now to avoid paying more later.
Mark Cuban is a billionaire who owns an NBA team, the Dallas Mavericks. So it may surprise you he purchases everyday items like razor blades and toothpaste in bulk batches, stuff he knows he'll use. Here's the thinking behind bulk buying. Purchasing goods in volume, it's cheaper than buying them one at a time. You save on transaction costs, like driving to the store. If your money in a savings or checking account is losing value to inflation, like it would be right now, why not spend some on items that may be more costly in the future? I emailed Cuban about his strategy. This is what he wrote back. The money you save by investing in bulk will provide a better return on investment than any investment vehicle on the planet. So I called up Russ Roberts and asked him to meet me at a Costco in Washington, D.C. Roberts is an economist and a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He says, what if inflation starts climbing to, say, 5%?
You have an investment right now that pays 5%. And the answer is not easily. Your mutual fund might achieve a 5% return. The stock market's done well lately, but that's lately. There's been some bad years. Your savings account doesn't pay anything close to that. So it's certainly true that cash, if you can spare it to convert your cash into real goods whose price is rising, that's not a bad idea.
Being an economist, Roberts is trained to look for trade-offs.
There are some limits to the value of that advice, one being the size of your house.
So with storage capacity and global prices in mind, we set off.
So should we start here with food?
Spinach and cheese ravioli. Like to try one today, sir?
Food prices bounce around a lot. This year, the Agriculture Department predicts they will increase between 2.5% and 3.5%. We're looking at stacks of nuts. One argument in their favor? They keep well.
I prefer the pecans to the walnuts in it, and I think I'm going to go for those. So this is a pretty big bag of pecans. It's 2 pounds for $13.99.
Pecans are an American specialty, and exports to pecan-loving destinations like Hong Kong and Vietnam grew strongly last year. So if demand stays high overseas, prices could jump, and my pecan purchase would be a good deal as well as a tasty one. Now we're over at Household Supplies, where the trash and lawn bags bulge in surprisingly heavy boxes.
We haven't talked about oil prices yet, and I know that they use petroleum in making these bags.
They're high historically right now. There's tension in the Middle East. It could be the cause, or it could be world demand and growth. China has been another argument as to why oil prices are high right now. So they could easily come down, in which case this would not be a good bet. But if the Middle East heats up, which of course it can, this could be a good purchase.
Well, that didn't solve anything.
But I would say the advantage of the trash bag investment is you get 200. 200. It's 13 bucks. You buy three of these, you got 600 trash bags, you are set for a long, long time. And they don't take that much room up in your garage.
And this is an item you know you're going to use, right? I mean, this is the whole purpose here, is to buy items you know you will be using, right? And trash happens.
Inevitably.
When it comes to bulk buying, there's more than thinking about prices. You can wind up thinking about yourself in the future. That's what's happening in the underwear section now. There's little doubt the 2 6-packs of T-shirts I'm eyeing are priced right. They're less than $4 per shirt. But buying 12 T-shirts? It's a long-term commitment to staying who you are, physically.
Do you think this could be sort of a good behavioral prod for me if I just bought the large in volume to keep me from going up to the next size, to the extra large?
Yeah. Putting down a bond, basically. You're investing to say, if I mess up and don't eat right and exercise insufficiently, I will throw away that money.
Now, throwing away money isn't the purpose of this undertaking. I have $5,000 to work with, money that I'm willing to take out of a savings account that's not keeping up with inflation. I'm looking for alternatives that might fare better.
All right, toothpaste, pecans, big bag of onions. We're getting my items rung up here. Zantac, I missed that. Lounge pants, $9.97. Razor blades, $43.99. T-shirts, $19.99. Total is $303.53.
$303.53. My first investment in this project. How can I tell if it pays off? It pays off if I use what I've bought, and I come back to the store in, say, a year, and the price tag on my items is higher than it is today. Uri Berliner, NPR News.
NPR aired a series last year called Poisoned Places, about regions living with industrial pollution. We're reviving that series this week, but the news isn't all grim. This morning, we take a look at a city that has cleaned up its air, Houston.
That metropolitan area is home to hundreds of petrochemical plants. They produce about a quarter of the nation's gasoline and about a third of the plastics that are in our cars, cupboards, and just about everywhere else. In the last decade, Houston's air has improved dramatically.
How that happened is a tale of new technology and a Texas law that prompted companies to disclose what they were emitting. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
If you want to get to the heart of Houston's petrochemical industry, take a trip out onto the Houston Ship Channel. It's a muddy brown body of water that's surrounded by refineries, tank farms, and petrochemical companies as it winds inland from Galveston Bay toward downtown. Dana Bloom is standing on the deck of a fireboat plying the channel. She's been monitoring the air and water for the Port of Houston Authority for the past 14 years. And she says you sure notice those smoggy summer days.
It's hot. It's harder to breathe. I mean, I'm fortunate I don't have respiratory issues, but I do worry about my child and other children who play on days that it's a high ozone day.
In recent years, those high ozone days have come less often, and they're less intense when they do strike.
I can look out of my office window now and almost every single day see downtown, and that wasn't the case 10 years ago.
To get the surprising backstory about how Houston's air got cleaner, it's worth a visit to Harvey Jeffries at the University of North Carolina's School of Public Health in Chapel Hill. As this retired professor tells the story, air pollution regulators were on the verge of making a multi-billion dollar mistake. This involves a little chemistry. Ozone is created in the air when one kind of pollution, nitrogen oxide, reacts in sunlight with other chemicals called volatile organic compounds. Regulators were focusing their efforts overwhelmingly on nitrogen oxides, cranking down on them so hard, compliance would cost $4 billion a year. Jeffries says, big mistake.
If you spent the $4 billion, if you did all the cleanup, they were controlling the wrong thing, and they wouldn't do anything to actually prevent the true cause of the highest ozone.
Jeffries says, sure, you need to control nitrogen oxides, but the most bang for the buck would come from cutting back on volatile organic compounds, like ethylene, which is used to make polyethylene plastic. Chemicals like these are produced in abundance along the ship channel.
You're talking about billions of pounds of fluids and liquids a day being produced in Houston. And if you only lose 0.0001% of that, it's a massive amount of material. And that was being ignored totally, completely.
Jeffries pointed to a massive scientific study the state of Texas had funded in the year 2000. Results from that showed that volatile chemicals were a big culprit and, happily for industry, cheaper to fix. And it wasn't just the day-to-day emissions, but big, unexpected releases. For instance, sometimes plants release potent chemicals like ethylene in order to prevent a catastrophe.
Ethylene is more explosive than hydrogen, and they're making billions of pounds of ethylene. And so it's not something that you want to sort of fool around with. And if there's likely to be a big back pressure or something like this, you want a safety valve to go off.
And when a valve goes off, tens of thousands of pounds of these chemicals can vent into the air all at once. If the sun is beating down and the wind is blowing in the right direction, a narrow plume of smog can form. Because smog forms over the course of a few hours, often these plumes appear in the suburbs, miles from the ship channel. Typically now, a bad air day in Houston is caused by one of these narrow plumes, not a city-wide miasma as you find in Los Angeles or Dallas. Scientists link those plumes of smog to these chemical burps thanks to a Texas law that required industry to report unexpected events in a public database.
And as soon as all this became visible, voila, it got cleaned up.
Just a few years after Houston had won the title of the worst air in the country, residents finally tasted success.
Beginning in 2005, 6, 7, the peak ozone concentration dropped in a straight line until in 2009, Houston achieved, for the first time in 35 years, the ambient ozone standard that was in effect at that time.
It's not only that scientists had finally identified the problem, they also had a new technology to help them address it. That's a camera that can see what the human eye cannot. It looks at infrared light. And when a chemical like ethylene is in the air, it appears in the infrared camera like a dark cloud. Jason Harris from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality was on the side of the road just north of the Houston Ship Channel one winter morning looking out at tank farms for signs of leaks.
We look at any and all sources we can see from roadways or other public areas. We're looking for those unrecognized or unauthorized emission sources.
And in a typical day, do you see a leak or do you not see a leak?
I'd say more often than not, we don't find anything, which is good news.
But in the early days of this technology, it was quite a different story.
We did some flyovers of the ship channel. We attached a similar camera to a helicopter and flew over the industrial areas and saw some pretty eye-opening things.
Barges carting chemicals up and down the channel turned out to be leaking this stuff into the air. And some types of storage tanks turned out to leak as well. Steve Smith from the chemical giant LyondellBasell says his company didn't want to lose its products into the air, so they bought 9 of the infrared cameras at about $100,000 apiece to find their own leaks.
And we are able to fix things sooner, and we are able to fix the right things, as opposed to thinking that it might be one problem when in fact the camera shows us something different, and therefore we can do the right thing sooner and obviously have lower emissions and a cleaner environment.
And of course, save the company money by reducing its pollution taxes and avoiding potential fines. Larry Soward was one of the commissioners on the Texas Environmental Board during those critical years when Houston's air improved. He says getting industry to this point wasn't quite as painless as you hear tell these days.
Well, early on, they came kicking and screaming because it meant either major investments for technology or it meant major operational changes.
But change they did, and gradually many companies came to realize that tightening up their leaks and reducing their accidental releases gave them a competitive advantage.
At least your leading industry, some of your Exxon Mobils, your LyondellBasells, those type of industries really began to see that it was in their economic benefit to not only comply but to get ahead of the curve.
The question now for these industries, in fact for all of Houston, is what next? Despite all the improvement, the air quality still falls short of increasingly stringent federal health standards. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we'll hear how getting that next big improvement could be tough. Poison Places is a collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. A farmer in Oregon has found some genetically engineered wheat growing on his land. This was an unwelcome surprise because this type of wheat has never been approved for commercial planting. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's investigating, trying to find out how this wheat got there. The USDA says there is no risk to public health, but wheat exporters are worried about how their customers in Asia and Europe will react to this. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
The biotech company Monsanto has genetically altered some of America's biggest crops so they can tolerate the weed killer glyphosate or Roundup. It did this with corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton, but it did not do this with wheat. It made Roundup-tolerant wheat in the laboratory, and it carried out field trials of genetically engineered wheat in 16 different states. But the country's wheat growers told the company they did not want this novel genetic trait.
Part of the concern was export markets.
Steve Mercer is vice president of communications of U.S. Wheat Associates, which represents wheat growers and exporters.
We're not in favor of commercializing any biotech trait unless it's gone through the regulatory approvals in the U.S. and in other countries.
Many countries are quite hostile to genetically engineered crops, so Monsanto dropped the wheat project. It never asked for government approval, and it ended its field trials in 2005. Fast forward 8 years. About a month ago, a farmer in eastern Oregon noticed some wheat plants growing where he didn't expect them, and they didn't die when he sprayed them with Roundup. The farmer sent samples of these curious plants to a scientist at Oregon State University. She found that this wheat was, in fact, genetically engineered. She passed samples on to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and yesterday, the USDA confirmed it. In a statement, the USDA's Bernadette Juarez said her agency is collecting more samples from the farm, conducting more tests.
We have a team of dedicated investigators working on the ground daily to figure out what's going on here.
Nobody knows how this wheat got there. Monsanto's last field trials in Oregon were in 2001. After all such trials, the crops are supposed to be completely removed from the fields. Also, nobody knows how widely this genetically engineered wheat has spread, whether it's been in fields of wheat that were harvested for food, for instance. The USDA says even if it has, there's no danger to public health. Still, if further tests show that this unapproved wheat has spread into the food supply, it could play havoc with wheat sales. In 2006, unapproved genetically engineered rice was discovered throughout the American rice harvest, and it shut down practically all exports for a while. Exporters lost millions of dollars. The wheat harvest is much bigger. Steve Mercer from U.S. Wheat Associates says there's no indication so far that this will happen in wheat. Right now, it's just a few isolated plants growing in eastern Oregon.
We're now in the process of getting in touch with all of our customers. You know, we're going to work to make sure that they have all the information that they need and reassure them that this isolated trait hasn't entered commerce.
So far, he says, those customers are not making any decisions. They're just asking for more information. Dan Charles, NPR News.
If Al Capone were alive today, this is how he would be hiding his money. Those words yesterday from the head of the Criminal Investigation Division at the IRS. He was talking about Liberty Reserve, an online currency exchange now accused of operating a $6 billion money laundering operation. It's believed to be the largest online money laundering case in history. According to prosecutors, Liberty Reserve was a financial hub for online criminal activity, ranging from computer hacking to child pornography to narcotics trafficking. So how did this online currency exchange work? We're joined by Kara Scannell, U.S. regulatory correspondent with the Financial Times, to explain. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Kara, let's follow the money. If I wanted to create an account at Liberty Reserve, what do I have to do?
Well, it's fairly simple. You just have to fill out an online form where you put in your first name, your last name, an address, and an email address. And you have an account set up just as easy as that. In fact, as part of this investigation, an undercover law enforcement official did open an account using the name Joe Bogus with the account name To Steal Everything. And he made up his address as 123 Fake Main Street, completely made up city, New York.
And somehow that didn't tip the folks at Liberty Reserve off to something that might be afoot.
Well, that's the issue in this case, is that in these online virtual currency businesses, they don't verify or validate, or at least Liberty Reserve didn't verify or validate any of the information of its customers. And that's how people were able to use the anonymity in order to launder what is alleged to be $6 billion.
Okay, well, let's say I have this Liberty Reserve account set up and I want to put real money into it, real dollars into it. What do I have to do?
Well, in the case of Liberty Reserve, they operated using these, quote, third-party exchangers that would serve as the middleman between the account that you might have at a bank where the money is and Liberty Reserve. So it sort of acts as a buffer, and it cuts down on the actual paper trail that leads back to you specifically and in your transactions. So if you put your money in a Western Union account, transferred it to this exchange company, they would then translate your actual dollars into LR, the virtual currency, and then transfer that to Liberty Reserve.
So I have money that's now LR, this virtual currency, at Liberty Reserve. And what does that allow me to do? Is it purely the anonymity, the lack of being able to be traced, that's the advantage there?
Yeah, that seems to be the main advantage, because if you're dealing with money that's obtained illegally, whether through drug trafficking or cyber hacking, then you don't want it to be traced back to your actual self. So it allows people to, quote, clean the money and then pull it out or distribute it to other people that they need to pay using this virtual currency that is then translated once again from a LR through the exchange companies into actual cash.
So one thing you could do would be to transfer money among accounts that Liberty Reserve held, right? So if there were another criminal activity that you were doing business with, you could trade money on this exchange and no one would know.
That's right.
Let me ask you this, Kara. You cover the regulatory world. Are there regulations that govern this new world of online currency exchanges, or is this pretty much the Wild West?
Online currency exchanges have been around for about 10 years or so from people I've spoken with. I think more recently, and it's earlier this year, in fact, the Treasury Department issued a notice to banks and financial institutions and these virtual currency exchange operators to say that if you are going to do business, you do have to have certain, you do have to register with the U.S. and you do have to follow by U.S. rules if you're going to have any accounts in the U.S. or involving U.S. citizens. And some of those requirements are this Know Your Customer rule. So it puts these exchanges on the hook if they're in fact engaging with terrorist financing or drug trafficking.
I've been talking with Kara Scannell, U.S. regulatory correspondent with the Financial Times, about the online currency exchange Liberty Reserve. Kara, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. One of the biggest meat processors in China has just bought one of the biggest pork producers in America. Smithfield Foods announced yesterday that it is being acquired by a Chinese firm for nearly $5 billion. The U.S. company insists it will continue with business as usual. But as Peggy Lowe of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports, the sale could affect hog farmers and consumers, and it's not a done deal just yet.
Okay, I'm intentionally mixing metaphors here, but when Wall Street traders heard the news yesterday that Smithfield had sold to Hong Kong-based Shuangwei, they reacted, well, bullishly.
The trade was looking at this as positive, as bullish for U.S. pork exports, you know, down the road. At least that's the current thinking.
That's Dan Norsini, an independent commodities broker. Most people in the industry agreed with him on that simple forecast that the sale will mean more U.S. pork for the growing Chinese demand. But Norsini says the big unknown is just how the new owners will run the company.
If the Chinese come to own Smithfield, will Smithfield be at the dictates of his Chinese owner, or will they let market forces determine whether they're going to expand their herd size or not? I mean, that's a big question because it could impact the rest of the industry.
That means if the Chinese ratchet up production, prices could go down for individual farmers, many of whom struggled last year feeding their animals corn made more expensive by the drought. But notice that other unknown. Norsini said if the Chinese come to own Smithfield, the deal must still be approved by the U.S. government. And many wonder whether Shuangwei's previous troubles with food safety could complicate the deal. 2 years ago, the company was involved in a scandal that included feeding its pigs an additive banned in the U.S. It's called clenbuterol. It makes the hogs leaner, but can increase heart rates, tremors, and headaches when the meat is consumed. Elizabeth Holmes of the Center for Food Safety says U.S. regulators should take a hard look at the deal.
They're supposed to identify and address any national security concerns that would arise. I can't imagine how something like public health or environmental pollution couldn't be potentially construed as a national security concern.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good.
We got some really good pork chops and T-bones today.
Those are really good.
While the news of the Smithfield sale circled the globe, and a small butcher shop in Kansas City, it was met with, well, a shrug. And another order straight from the meat case, wrapped up in white paper. The literally named local pig is the antithesis of the huge vertically integrated Smithfield operation, where more than 16 million animals are slaughtered every year. The owner, Alex Pope, says he hopes consumers take the Smithfield news as a wake-up call and seek out other options when buying their meat.
You're going to hopefully look for Smithfield on the back of a label of bacon. So that's the first step in saying, I don't want to be part of that. I want an option. I would like to go to a small local producer at a farmer's market or at a locally sourced butcher shop and buy that bacon, ask them where it came from, ask them where the pigs were raised and how they were treated.
At least one environmental group complains that the proposed sale would create a cross-country bacon behemoth and says it may try to block it in court. But if the Shanghai-Smithfield deal doesn't go through, Smithfield reportedly has two other suitors standing by. Bloomberg reports that another Asian company and one from Brazil were preparing takeover bids for Smithfield when the deal with Shanghai was announced. For NPR News, I'm Peggy Lowe.
And that story came to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting collaboration that focuses on agriculture and food production.